Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian for the week of the 8th of March 2010. I'm Alex Kratosky, and in this program, we're fluctuating between the old and the new. We'll be taking a step back in time to look at some old school machines with Bobby Johnson at the Musée Mécanique in San Francisco.
Standing in front of a 1922 Seberg KT Special. It's a player piano with the percussion of a bass drum, a snare drum, a tambourine, timpani, wood blocks, castanet, triangle, cymbal, piano, and mandolin. And it all comes to life for only a quarter.
That was a bit of machine-made music there from the Musée Mécanique, which we'll hear more from after the news. And we'll be focusing on the future of digital in a week when the BBC has been under fire for its contradictory attitudes in its strategic review. What is to become of digital radio, digital on-demand content, and digital rights in the big British castle? It's a packed program, and joining me to detangle the issues are Charles Arthur and Rick Ray in the studio. Welcome to you both to the pod. It's great to have you.
Great to be here. I like the dictionary that's got detangle in it.
Yes, absolutely. Listen, I can neologism, as it were, for Britain. Thank you very much. Well, of course, the podcast wouldn't be complete without a debate about the latest tech news from around the web or without your feedback. So there will be a healthy dollop of each. Enjoy the next 30 minutes of technological nirvana at the hands of The Guardian's Tech Weekly podcast.
Tech Weekly from guardian.co.uk.
Here are the big stories from the tech world this week.
On digital radio and online. BBC Six Music.
Six Music. Six Music.
First, BBC Director General Mark Thompson's strategic review to the BBC Trust ricocheted around the media circus, kicking the new media enclave in a region that can only be described as below the belt. While staunchly standing up for the digital future, his review weighed heavily against the BBC's digital services, including digital radio, digital channels, and its substantial library of websites. Charles, tell us what was in the review.
BBC Six Music and the BBC Asian Network to be cut. A bigger focus on doing things in terms of drama and production with the BBC. Releasing, I think it's 600 million or 800 million. It's a lot of millions for more production within the BBC. And cutting the website by a half or a quarter, depending on which side you looked at it from, and certainly reducing the number of staff. Eric Huggers explained that what he's talking about in this reducing the website thing is that they have lots of sort of top-level domains, things like bbc.co/spooks, for example. He's saying, well, we're going to have rather fewer of those. There's a lot of them mothballed at the moment, and that basically you're not going to see so many of those sort of specialist sites within the BBC.
The one that also got me was Six Music, which I have to admit I have listened to in the past, haven't more recently because I've got old and I've been listening to Radio 3. I'm sorry. Six Music actually spends about £7 million on programming, so the actual savings there are relatively small. And it's this odd thing that everyone knows, most people understand, that the BBC has to reduce its remit, but as soon as it starts naming specific areas, you have these, lots of people start writing letters saying, oh, you can't cut that, you can't cut that, you must cut something else. It's, you know, it's,
well, at least these days, I mean, it's they don't write a letter, they have a tweet campaign.
Well, they have a tweet campaign, exactly.
And a twibbon, and, you know, start a number 10 petition and all the sorts of things that generally don't have a great deal of effect.
All of which, of course, are digital, which is interesting.
Well,
now,
yes.
Rick, actually, after you suggested this, after throwing its weight behind the new technologies that it seems to have done, it seems that the public service broadcaster is actually doubting the foundations that it worked so hard to build. Does this mean that digital broadcasting in the future is on shaky ground?
No, not at all. I just think that they've had plenty of opportunity. Well, they've had the field to a certain extent to themselves for quite some time. So they've obviously just run to the edges, gone as far as they could possibly go, and now they're having to retrench slightly and decide on particular areas where they think they should focus. They're just trying lots. They've tried lots and lots of things. Some of them very successful, some slightly less successful, and now they've just got to say, okay, well, we'll focus on these particular areas. Which, I mean, a lot of this obviously is being seen through the prism of politics, which is that the BBC does this now rather than have the Tories, possibly, unless we have a hung parliament, do it for them in a couple of months' time.
Well, the one of the main focuses of the campaigns have been these digital radio services. Now that people can get their digital audio signals on TVs, on games consoles, on various other platforms, is it simply that the BBC diversified too much, or is it that the technologies have moved away from them at such a rapid rate that they can't keep up with it?
Just on the specifically digital radio point, digital radio is here to stay for one reason and one reason only, which is that they are going into cars. And the long lead time that you get on a new model when everyone farts about changing all the different ways that they can put the wheels on the car, that process does take a good few years. So the models that are coming out in 3 or 4 years' time have digital radios built into them. The parts have been ordered, everything's turning up into the factories, and everything's going to be put together. So digital radio, per se, will continue to be here. Exactly how many different channels we get, it's the same with television. I mean, if you watch Owl TV and Fire TV and God knows what else on Sky. And in a good few years' time, a lot of those channels aren't there. And this, we're having the same thing with radio. It doesn't mean... but the classic one for this, and it's always been the digital debate, that as soon as something gets closed down, everyone goes, oh, digital doesn't work. 8 out of 10 restaurants go bust in the first year, and no one says that eating out is not viable. And it's exactly the same with digital. Just because a website goes bust does not mean the internet is not going to work or digital isn't going to work. And it's the same with the BBC and radio.
Well, it's some just a shame.
Stats just about digital radio and digital radio listening out of the latest Radars, which is the sort of survey of radio listening, which is that digital radio listening to DAB is at 21.1% of all listening. And for the analog radio switch off to happen, 50% of listening has to be digital by 2013. So people are going to have to buy a lot of cars in the next few years, and they're going to have digital radios in for this to really happen.
Well, it's not been a good week for the BBC, because also making headlines around the web is Anti's battle with the open source community. Specifically, technical changes to the iPlayer made last week conflict with the open source viewer XBMC. Now, Charles, using as little tech lingo as possible, remember you're speaking to me here, can you explain what is happening?
The BBC's iPlayer, when you start a stream from the iPlayer, it sends out a query to the viewer that you're using saying, hey, who are you? What sort of flash player are you? I'd really like to know who you are and get to know you better. And it sends, the flash player sends back a little thing saying, I'm flash player 10.1, or I'm XBMC. And if it's XBMC, it says, the BBC says, oh, I don't want to know you. Next. So what's been happening is that people find they're watching stuff on XBMC and suddenly the stream cuts off after a few minutes.
So what you're telling me is that XBMC is butch and the flash players are all a little bit fey. Is that
something
what you're saying?
Something like that, yes. But well, not in a sort of prejudicial way.
And this is all changed because they made a few changes to the technology behind iPlayer.
Yeah, the BBC has tweaked it and is being rather difficult about why it's tweaked it. It insists that it's not trying to discriminate against XBMC, and yet it's rather hard to see it, you know, what ways this doesn't discriminate against XBMC.
Well, Tech Weekly listener Dodge weighed in on Jack Schofield's blog post about this. He said that the BBC is getting itself up and it's stickier and stickier gum tree. For my part, I believe that they have to be a public broadcaster, and this means allowing anyone to receive their streams in any way they like, i.e. any make of TV, and to save these programs locally, i.e. use a VCR to record them. They should be fighting on our behalf the rights the studios are trying to impose over distribution of media. Any illegality is not caused by viewing programs or by saving them. It's caused by the people who illegally put them on file-sharing websites and those that download them. Well, the iPlayer, other catch-up services and video content providers have been under the microscope of the government's watchdog Ofcom, who's looking at net neutrality regulation for internet traffic management. Rick, what do you expect the Ofcom report will say?
What they're doing is they're starting a consultation process on what they should think about net neutrality. At some point in the spring, they will give us their sort of rough idea, but in true and classic Ofcom style, they've got slightly the wrong end of the telescope. Net neutrality is the idea that all traffic over the internet should be treated the same. Now, for a lot of people, that debate, certainly in the States, is all about the idea that if you're providing content, if you're, say, the BBC or Hulu or whoever, a large film studio in the US, you should be allowed to send your content to an end user without having that content interfered by the ISP. But what the debate really is about is trying to get these large content companies to start paying for their traffic being carried by the ISPs. At the moment, the BBC spends a couple hundred million pounds a year paying companies like Akamai and Level 3 to cache their content close to the ISPs' networks. Now, as far as the BBC is concerned, that means that they get better service and that they've helped put some money into the sort of access community, and that's sorted. As far as the ISPs are concerned, they don't see that money, and they're actually carrying all the traffic. So what they would like to do is say, OK, BBC, if you want, say, the HD iPlayer, and you want it available during 6 o'clock and 8 o'clock in the evening, which is the peak time for us, pay us X amount of money, and we will guarantee you that service.
And this is what Ofcom's looking at. It's saying this is unfair.
So the idea is what Ofcom is worried about is it's worried about some of the ISPs are also connected with content companies. Now, the obvious one here is Sky. So if Sky says, tell you what, Sky Broadcast, we will offer you a really good deal so your channels can always be seen to our broadband customers. The BBC channels will suddenly fall off a cliff between 6 and 8. That's what Ofcom does not want to happen. It doesn't want discrimination. It's pretty much, bizarrely enough, if we get past all the rhetoric, and there's an awful lot of people with an awful lot of positions on this, but if you get past the rhetoric, it's the same position that the mobile phone companies have, who also want to be able to control people, but want to be able to offer all content companies exactly the same sort of packages. It's also the same thing that Google wants. Everyone always says that Google wants net neutrality, blah, 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 blah. But Eric Schmidt at Mobile World Congress a couple of weeks ago was very specific that he doesn't care if the content companies actually have to pay to have a better service, as long as everyone is treated exactly the same. So if Google says, tell you what, we'll give you some money so YouTube's brilliant between 6 and 8 in the evening, Hulu, iPlayer, anyone else can come in and say, we want exactly the same deal, and the ISP has to give it to them. So bizarrely, it's a bit of a storm in a teacup.
You can catch up on all these stories and more, including news that doesn't feature the BBC, at guardian.co.uk/technology. Finally, on last week's podcast, we asked what real effect the web browser chooser that Windows included in its latest update would have on users' decisions to move away from Microsoft's proprietary Internet Explorer in favor of the alternatives like Firefox, Safari, Google, Chrome, and Opera. Andrew Kerr got in touch on the blog, and he said, a lot of people don't realize that some browsers are really much faster than others, with Internet Explorer being about the slowest and Opera actually being the fastest from cold start. Chrome is also really fast and very elegant, i.e. is painfully slow and probably most vulnerable to hack attacks. The five-figure man adds, I don't think that this development will make much difference. The majority of users will not benefit from the choice of browsers. To most people, a page is a page is a page, and anybody who actually cares will already have tried out the alternatives. Now, that actually echoes something that Bobby said last week. If you have any views on this or anything we discuss on today's podcast, do get in touch. You can find us on Twitter, Facebook, Flickr, and at guardian.co.uk/techweekly.
Now, most of the time on the show, we talk about games and entertainment, and we're talking about games consoles, Nintendo, Microsoft, Sony, you know, the PlayStation generation. But it's not always been like that, obviously. Now, we're here in San Francisco in the Musée Mécanique, which is a sort of tribute to some of the old amazing mechanical games and arcade games of the past. And I'm here with Dan Zielinski, who's the curator, the guy who runs it all. Dan, can you just tell us a bit about why you started doing this and how you started and what goes on here at the museum?
I got into it because my father got into it first. He got his first machine back in 1933, and it was by accident. He was playing bingo, and he won the main prize. And the main prize, the big prize, was a case of oil for a car. At 11 years old, he had no use for that whatsoever. So he took the oil home and he sold it to his piano teacher for 50 cents. And then he went to a store here on Ellis Street where they sold old antique machines, and he bought a machine for 50 cents, a little penny arcade machine that literally worked on a penny. And he took it home, and his mom and dad put pennies in it, and his friends put pennies in it, and he soon had another 50 cents, and he went out and bought another machine. This went on for decades. As you can see, there's well over 200 machines here now, and I grew up with these machines in my basement. He was collecting long before I was born, and I've grown up with these machines, and I love these machines, so I can't turn my back on them. It's just a wonderful experience being here.
Well, given that you've talked about it, let's go and see what we can see in the museum itself.
This machine we're looking at is called Laughing Sal. She was a on permanent display here in San Francisco at Whitney's Playland at the Beach, which was right at the ocean by the Cliff House. Anyway, so it came up at auction at some place called Butterfields and Butterfields, and my dad and I decided to put in a silent bid, assuming that there'd be no chance of us getting it, because this was a landmark of San Francisco, a mechanical landmark, so to speak. And 2 weeks later, they said, "She's yours, come get her." No one else even bid on it.
So what happens when we go and put some money in? What's she going to do, laugh? And
Oh, she laughs and she moves back and forth. I'll fire it up if you want.
Let's have a go. All right. So now we've put our money in, and Laughing Sal is now kind of rocking backwards and forwards and laughing like a dray. She's really going for it.
We made a new dress for her, a new wig. We had to paint her, a new motor, redo the transmission, built a whole new display case.
This is kind of on the entrance to the museum, which is one of the disturbing things. I find a lot of the things in here have a sort of creepy quality, and this is maybe the creepiest because it's so enormous. It's, what is it, like 5 feet tall?
Standing in front of her, she's a little under 6 feet when she's standing upright, yeah.
I mean, the sound of her laughing, where does that come from? Is that the original laugh that she's got?
It's the original soundtrack. I've just had it remastered over the years. You know, it originally was on a wire recorder, and then it was on an endless loop tape. It was on an LP. It was on an auto-reverse cassette tape. Now I forget what it is, some kind of electronic recording. I don't even remember what I put in there.
Standing in front of the end of the trail, which is kind of everybody's favourite because it's so amazingly, to me, underwhelming. You know, it's a little vignette, and there are actually a lot of vignettes around the place, but this one, you put your money in and the wind blows. That's it. We've got a sort of bleak western scene of a wagon that's dilapidated and fallen apart, and the kind of carcasses of dead animals. And I'm assuming there's a fan hidden in here somewhere. You put your money in, the fan turns on, and the tattered remnants of the wagon cover flap in the wind. Yes. And that's it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's kind of beautiful in its in its simplicity, but I can't help feeling that if I don't know what somebody would have paid to turn this on back in the day.
It used to be a nickel.
But did they not feel a little bit cheated?
Oh, absolutely. Oh, yeah, they used to call it end of the nickel, yes.
The number of vignettes that are around here, I mean, there are sort of circus scenes and fairgrounds and barn dances and all kinds of machines.
They were built for a specific reason, like to advertise different businesses. Like if you had a World's Fair or a trade fair, something like that, at Moscone Center many, many years ago, you could watch it and remember the advertising. And that's what a few of these are. Mm. So they're only one of a kind. I don't know how many end of the trails were, but I think there's only one left.
It's not necessarily a bad thing. So we're standing in front now of well, you'll recognize the brand name. It's a Wurlitz, but it doesn't look like a Wurlitz I've seen before. I mean, this looks like a player piano, but it's also got, and this is the thing I like, it's got drums in it. There's a snare drum I see, a small bass drum, even a triangle.
This also has a rank of flute pipes. That's what these are in the very back above the piano harp. This operates on air pressure and vacuum. The pressure's for the pipes and the vacuum is for the piano. This came with beautiful art glass, leaded stained glass window in it. But we've got clear glass so you can see all the mechanism in it because people are more interested in how things work and they love watching all this. I mean, just the rewind mechanism over there is so hokey, you know, but it'll work forever. It just sits there like flapping, like looks like an albatross trying to fly.
Would one of these run to originally? Do you have any idea?
I would guess this is maybe $2,300, give or take. By today's standards, they're really inexpensive. But, you know, back in the day, that was an astronomical amount of money.
So it's not just, you know, old machines that you have from the, you know, from the 1800s and the earlier 1900s. We're in the corner now where, Dan, you've got a load of sort of 1980s, 90s arcade games and pinball machines. Is this the area that, of the collection that you're still developing, or how? Why are you doing this and not just all these mechanical objects?
Basically, what I'm trying to do is show the evolution of the industry, the coin-operated entertainment industry. And it starts from my oldest machine, and it goes, which is about 1884, to modern machines and a modern pinball machine like Pirates of the Caribbean. Even these video games date back to the late 70s.
Yeah, I mean, we've got Millipede from Atari right in front of us, which was a pretty pioneering game. I spent a long time playing that as a kid. Is it easier to keep the modern machines up to date? Because as you were saying earlier, I mean, some of these are running on the original motors. That player piano we just saw, it's still got most of the original parts inside.
There's replacement parts for everything.
Laughing Sal, right at the beginning, people who lived in San Francisco will probably remember her if they were around at the time. But these things obviously relate to a lot more people because they saw them.
I have kids walk past all the antiques, and they'll walk up to these video games and say, look, they have antiques, and they're looking at a game from the early 80s. So it's in the eyes of the beholder. It's really how old you are, where you're from, what you grew up playing. They all have the same effect on people. It's just different people.
So where does it go from here? I mean, video game arcades aren't as prevalent as they used to be. You know, we don't see much in the way of the mechanical machines anymore. You know, people carry their entertainment around with them a lot now.
Yeah, I know.
So how are you going to cope with that?
I don't want to really change anything, because there's very little of yesterday that's the same. That's what makes this unique. It's still here, intact and working, just like it was decades ago. And so that's my goal, is just to keep it as it is. Maybe do a little dusting from time to time, you know.
Bobby Johnson at Fisherman's Wharf in San Francisco. If you want more information on the Musée Mécanique, go to museemecanique.org. Last month, the Guardian's Mercedes Bunce went to the Digital Life Design Conference in Munich, where she met Blaise Aguera y Arcas from Bing, Microsoft's search engine.
We don't need queries and keywords if they bring back questions and confusion. From this moment on, search overload is officially over. It's time for the one and only 100% engineered to cut through the decision engine. Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, it's time to Bing and decide.
With a background in computer science and applied mathematics, Aguera y Arcas spent his illustrious career before being swept up by the Microsoft machine looking at structured data, creating award-winning applications like Photosynth for his startup, Sea Dragon. But while at DLD, he started by telling Mercedes what structured data can offer search.
Classically, when you open a web page, it's a document, an HTML document, and it already exists in its final form on a server somewhere, and you're really just reading it. So it's just unstructured text. That's what we call it, unstructured text. Unstructured meaning it's just characters, right, with formatting. Whereas there are a lot of other websites, more and more as time has gone on, where the HTML doesn't exist ahead of time. Instead, there's a database underlying all of that stuff. And the HTML doesn't exist until you request it. It gets generated in real time from that data, from that structured data, as we call it. So, for example, let's imagine a recipes website for a moment, where all of the recipes are stored on a database. So, for example, if I type tomato and garlic, it'll be understood that I'm probably interested in recipes that involve tomatoes and garlic, not the two Wikipedia entries on tomatoes and garlic or something. And then when those recipes come up, you know, it might still be just a list, but the point is that that list will be recipes that involve tomatoes and garlic as ingredients. So that's just one example of one of these verticals that's more semantic. Another example is, for example, travel. If you type Seattle to San Francisco, it's going to understand that you're interested in traveling from Seattle to San Francisco, and you'll get flight information. It's not as if on those flight websites the text Seattle to San Francisco occurred, right? It's understanding the aboutness of the query, if you see what I mean.
You showed some projects, some applications for your map project. Can you maybe just tell us some examples what these projects are about?
If I were to characterize the apps that are up, there are only a few apps up now, maybe a couple of dozen. And those apps divide into roughly three categories. Some of them look a lot like mashups. The difference is that a mashup happens on a third-party website, right, on a separate URL. And what we're doing is allowing those to be discovered right in the context of big maps, which is great for just the discoverability of those things. But those are the most conventional. Right? There are ones that are less conventional, that involve richer interactions and computation on the client side as well, that wouldn't be possible with a mashup, like destination maps is a wonderful one. This one allows you to type an address, and you specify a region of interest on the map, and it makes for you a kind of pirate map of that destination. So it downloads the bodies of water and the most important roads, and it deforms all of these things so that it expands the final few turns that you have to make, and it kind of hand letters it all and makes it look like it was written on a dirty napkin, and you can select different styles. So these are things that there's no way you could do in Ajax on another URL. It requires non-trivial calculations, and it requires downloading all this information about the roads from the mapping sites. It's a wonderful example. And then the last class that I think is we're going to see grow quite a lot over the coming months is things that really involve information at human scale. Stuff that is more like augmented reality and telepresence. And again, those are non-Ajax sort of things, right? You can't do those things with an ordinary.
Will maps be a way how you catch up with Google?
Well, it's fun to be the underdog, honestly, because you get to do a lot of innovating and a lot of experimenting and really trying very different approaches. And that very much is the approach that I would like to take, right? I'm not really interested in catching up, per se. Catching up implies that we are trying to duplicate, we're trying to match feature by feature, and I don't think that's the winning proposition. The whole point of Bing, of both Bing Maps and Bing as a whole, is to define a game that's a bit different from the game that Google is playing. I don't see it even being necessarily true that somebody is either in the Google camp or in the Bing camp. I would like to see what we're doing emerge as something that is actually quite different in a variety of ways from what Google has done. What we've done with maps, for example, is neither like Google's Ajax mapping site or the Ajax mapping site that Bing continues to support, nor is it like Virtual Earth or Google Earth. It's something else. So trying to define a different game, I think, is really key.
That was Mercedes Bunce speaking with Blaise Aguera y Arcas from Bing. Charles, do his claims stack up?
It depends which of the claims you're going for. I mean, in saying that they're not trying to catch up with Google, one's sort of tempted to go, okay, that's sort of true. I mean, what Microsoft really wants to do is to get ahead of Google, but not in terms of simple market share, but in terms of, well, we can do things that actually you hadn't thought about doing with Google. I mean, the problem that Google has is that it's still very much, its main business is being a search box, where I think Bing wants to redefine what it does to giving you much more things that you hadn't quite thought you wanted. Though I have to say, I wasn't very persuaded by the pirate maps thing. You know, the fact that you could create a pirate map on the fly that looks as though it's been drawn on a dirty napkin, don't say I feel the need for that very often.
Well, tell me, Rick, how is Bing faring against Google?
Well, yes, unfortunately, on the sort of simple search box side, that's where the money is. So, I mean, it does need, obviously, to get a bit of market share there. Last 3 months, looking for the Comscore data for November, December and January, Bing is on an upward trend compared to Google and it says it uses the Yahoo site. So just taking the Bing site itself, in the US, it just has has slightly over 10% of the market. So it's still, and obviously Google's got most of the rest. So it's a very big hill to climb, but it has picked up one percentage point in 3 months. That's the November to January timeframe, which actually is remarkably good, because when you look at the sheer number of searches that are being, searches themselves are increasing, so actually getting an increase in the market share means an awful lot more people are coming to use you on a regular basis. So it's a very, very, very big hill, but it is slowly climbing up it.
Well, Blaise was talking about some innovations, whether it's the pirate map or even potentially something like augmented reality. It was interesting to hear him blue sky, as it were, about these types of ideas. But Charles, do you think that how we search for things in the future will be radically different? Will Google, for example, be developing an augmented reality app for its search engines?
I don't think so, actually. I mean, I think that actually what you really want is very the sort of idea that Tim Berners-Lee puts about, which is the structured data idea, where if you're searching for tomatoes or something, then it knows that it's about a recipe in it, and it's able to pull those sorts of things in. Or if you go type in Ford, do you mean Ford the car? Do you mean fording, as in getting across a stream or something? And I was trying to imagine what the world would be like and what the internet would be like when actually you don't need to do searching, because you've got all the things that you want right there, in effect, and the things, your intentions, because Google has often been called a sort of a database of intentions. It's about, well, I want to go and find out about this. And what happens when you get to the point where actually you're not searching anymore, because all the things that you want sort of come to you because you've sort of declared your attention? I was trying to figure out how that would be, what sort of a world would that be like, and it'd be a very structured, data-intensive sort of world, but I could almost glimpse it.
Well, perhaps one that's been built by a computer scientist as opposed to a human being.
Possibly.
Rick, you wanted to say something?
No, only briefly, that obviously Google is interested in augmented reality, which has become the big thing of the last year or so, having a look at Yelp, whether or not it actually ever was going to buy it. But obviously Google Goggles as well, which on your mobile phone, which is quite funny. But essentially it's another, I mean, Google Goggles is basically another way of inputting data into that silly little search box, whereas Yelp is obviously the next thing along, which is taking where you are and trying to refer back information about where you are and what sort of things you might want in future.
Just very quickly, there'll be a feature about augmented reality in The Observer next Sunday.
Well, for more on search and the latest Bing news, head to guardian.co.uk/technology. That's it for this week. Thanks to Bobby Johnson and the crowd at Musée Mécanique, Mercedes Buns and Blaise Aguera y Arcas from Bing, and our in-house team, Charles Arthur, Rick Ray, and producer Scott. And don't forget, Tech Weekly is going live week after next at the Science Museum's DigiFest on the 23rd of March, Tuesday evening from 7 p.m. So head to danacenter.org for details and sign up for a ticket. Numbers are limited. Thanks very much for listening. I'm Alex Potoski.